hey, guys, we've got with us for a second time, Mr. Eric Quigley, a former player from Kentucky. So, Eric, welcome onto the show.
Thanks for having me, guys. Looking forward to part two. Looking forward to it.
That's right. That's right. You know, we had Eric on the show on episode 28 a couple years ago. At that point, he had just finished playing on the Pro Tour, and he was getting into coaching at Springhurst here in Louisville, Kentucky. In the past couple of years, I've gotten to know Eric quite a bit better and have really enjoyed the relationship and hearing some of the stories he's had to tell. And I think some of his experience and wisdom would be worth sharing again. So if you haven't listened to the first podcast, don't feel you need to listen to that to understand where we are from here. We'll probably ask some of the same questions, but given that it was 2 years later, I'm sure that our perspectives and his perspectives may have changed, so those answers may be different to the same questions. But with that, let's just start with, you know, the first question I have for you is, what do you believe now that you, or what do you believe now that you didn't believe 2 years ago when you first got into working with junior tennis development?
Well, first off, I'd like to say I think this is really cool to have me back, and I think it's an interesting way to do it, kind of asking me a lot of the similar questions and kind of how, you know, we're always evolving, and especially tennis players, and getting better. So it'll be interesting. I think this is really looking forward to this today. But one of the things that, you know, that's really changed, not really changed for me, but I've really noticed that I kind of stick to from lesson to lesson is, I feel like I'm a big stickler on like preparation and moving to the ball, getting the racket back. I think that's one of the things that I always kind of going back to, you know, from each lesson, just how important preparation is, moving to the ball, getting that racket back, and how much of a difference it makes and how much more options you have when you're prepared to hit a ball. And I always kind of use the analogy of kind of when you have a test coming up in school, you know, because I work with a lot of juniors. So I always use this analogy of when you have a test for school, you know, is it better to start studying as soon as when you find out there's a test and kind of work your way up, or cramming, you know, the night before? And it's kind of the same way moving to a forehand. It's better to, you know, start preparing right as you're moving to the ball versus trying to get your feet set, get your racket back, do everything all at the same time. Now I always have some of those students that are like, oh, I do better when I cram. So, but no, that's one of the biggest things. And, you know, I haven't really been able to travel with a lot of my students and watch them play. But when there are some, you know, the state tournaments here and, some Southern tournaments around Thanksgiving here in Louisville, I get to watch. And one of the biggest things I notice, that I guess kind of I just took for granted being, you know, playing at a high level, was just kind of the court awareness a little bit. I think a lot of kids, and I was the same way at this age, so it's something that I learned, but really try to pass along to a lot of the students that, you know, if they can learn at a quicker age or, you know, younger age, the better off they'll be. Is so many kids, you know, they're kind of wrapped up in what they do on the court and not really kind of seeing the big picture. And I think that's what pros do so well. And I had to learn this, you know, Cedric Kaufman, my, was at the time assistant coach at Kentucky, who's now the head coach. He kind of went to a couple tournaments with me on the pro tour, and he played himself. He was kind of what he was famous for is he had match points on Sampras at the French Open. He qualified that year and lost in five sets to Pete Sampras. And what he kind of, one of the tournaments he came with me was playing the percentages a little bit and understanding the percentages. I think a lot of kids, they put kind of more weight on a bigger point versus what's really happening in a match. And I think that's just something I've kind of noticed that a lot of kids could work on, just seeing what's really happening, where their opponent's errors are making, kind of not realizing what's going on the other side of the court. And they're just too wrapped up in, I think, what they're doing a little bit, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, Eric, yeah. one of the things in education in the world that we're in is that I'm in is we always talk about, you know, people are walking around and they just don't know what they don't know, right? Yep. And when they realize it, they realize how much work they have to do. And one of the most dangerous things you can do is walk around not knowing what you don't know. And exactly. So in the last 2 years, you know, you went from an exceptional player, still a great player. I mean, I would say that there's not many people in the world that could beat you even today getting off the couch. But with that being true, what is something in these last 2 years that you just didn't know that you realized and it really changed your outlook?
Coaching wise, you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, now, because here's the thing is now you went from playing yourself and being in control of your game. You know, in education, we talk a lot about the quality of the teacher can be measured by the sophistication of the student work, right? And so, and so as a coach in tennis, I would say the quality of the coach often can be measured by how many high quality players that they can produce, right? Because it doesn't really matter anymore what you can do. It matters what you can teach a kid to do when they walk on the court. So what are some of those things in the coaching world that you believe to be true or just didn't even know? And now that you know them, it's really changed your outlook.
Well, kind of one of the, I guess, most important things that I didn't realize now that I kind of really understand when I was growing up, I always heard my coach saying, like, how coachable are you? And I realize how important that is now for, you know, a lot of some kids, they, you know, kind of stuff goes in one ear and goes out the other. And so you spend multiple weeks, you know, trying to hone in on one thing versus kids that are really coachable and kind of grasp onto something. And that's not necessarily, you know, everyone learns different and doesn't mean that they're not listening. You just kind of, and maybe even kind of the way I'm saying it, just not hitting home a little bit. I think that's, you know, a characteristic of a great coach. They have ways of saying the same thing and it just kind of saying it until it kind of hits home to their player. And I think that's kind of like on me getting, you know, your student to grasp onto a certain technique or whatever it may be, strategy, whatever. But I think that's huge in tennis is understanding, being able to kind of pick up a concept and kind of run with it and understand what the philosophy behind it is and all that. And then being able to move on and get so much quicker, you know, when students can do that. So that's one of the things I didn't quite realize now being in it, how important it is for one, for kids to be coachable, and two, for me to be able to kind of, maybe they don't understand it when I'm saying it one way, but being able to kind of turn the same concept and say it a different way. So then maybe it hits home a little bit quicker. That makes sense.
Perfect sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So wanted to get back to what you mentioned earlier on, you know, kids not having what you call court awareness and how they can become more court aware. So, you know, like you say, you know, sometimes, like I say, my son played a match a few months ago. The kid had like his left arm, he couldn't move his left arm and he just never hit to his backhand. You know, he just kept getting inside out forehands. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, did you realize that the kid couldn't hit a backhand, you know? And he's just like, oh, well, I didn't see that. And I was like, well, how could you not see it?
Exactly.
So how can you make, you know, kids in the middle of a match, and, you know, we may get to this later when we talk about your pro career, because there's a match I want to ask you about, and maybe we can talk about it then too. But, you know, so what are some things that a kid can do during a match to become more aware? You know, little tricks that they might be able to use during a match that would help them identify a player's weakness or an unusual situation?
So kind of this was something I learned as I was playing pro, or kind of really feel like something that, going back to hitting home, it kind of hit home to me a little bit, talking to this kind of tennis psychologist a little bit. And I think I touched base on this last time that we talked in the podcast, but kind of it goes back to kind of putting yourself in their shoes a little bit instead of always kind of worried. And I was definitely guilty of this, but always worried about like kind of what I'm doing instead of kind of putting putting yourself in your opponent's shoes a little bit. So that kind of helped me take a little pressure off myself, realizing, for example, like if we're in the third set and my opponent serving for the match, instead of saying, gosh, if I don't break here, then the match is over, which is what most, I feel like what most people would think. And I mean, that's only natural. Mm-hmm. Instead of kind of working backwards and saying, okay, he's serving for it. Like, what does he not want? You know, obviously he probably wants some, you know, bunch of aces, free points. So he's probably a little nervous, doesn't want to play long points. So let me kind of work backwards and say, okay, he kind of wants some free points because that's what I would want. So let me put the ball in play a little bit, make him earn these shots. And if he hits great shots, I'm too good. So kind of just putting yourself in your opponent's shoes, I think is a good one. And just kind of really concentrating on that and realizing a lot of juniors, you know, want to play the perfect match all the time, which everybody does, because it would be, you know, you play the perfect match, you're probably going to win. But they're so worried about, you know, the mistakes they're making, especially on a break point. If I would have just made that shot, you know, this match would have been different. But just kind of not so worried about what you do and kind of thinking about what they're doing a little bit and kind of just putting yourself in their shoes and what's going on a little bit. So just I don't think there's an easy answer to that, but just really making a conscious effort of kind of seeing what's going on and not so worried about, gosh, I'm not playing good today, I didn't have a good warm up, blah, blah, you know, kind of going like that. So
that's good. And one of the things that, you know, my son struggles with is, you know, getting too caught up on losing a big point. You know, he'll lose a deuce game or something like that, and it turns into three games, you know. And so maybe that's something that, you know, you get a changeover every two games. Mm-hmm. You can't let it go on for more than the changeover. So there's something on the changeovers that they could be doing that would help them, you know, reset, refocus. What's something maybe that you might have done on your changeovers? I mean, I see a lot of the pros, they, you know, sort of have, you know, looks like, you know, if Rionic is on a changeover, he's doing some sort of mind yoga thing, and, you know, team does something mm-hmm. unique on the changeovers. What is something that maybe you've did on the changeovers that helped you sort of reset and got yourself back in the match?
Well, I think just an easy thing for anybody to do, and I was always told this, and I've seen, you know, Serena Williams do it. Just have a little list that you put in your bag of things that maybe that you kind of keep forgetting or whatever. And it could be as simple mm-hmm. as, like, you know, maybe lately you've been struggling with your ball toss, not getting it high enough. And that's something that a lot of people struggle with, especially under pressure. It's just something that they forget. Toss doesn't get as high. So you could just write down, you know, on your little list, hey, make sure we're getting that ball toss up there. Or just kind of making a list, because it's so easy in the moment to forget, you know, the stuff that your game plan was going into the match. So I think that's big. But just kind of maybe like a little reflection, kind of how did those last 2 points go? Like I said, I think a lot of kids, and I was the same way, you know, you play a great point, you come to the net and they hit one kind of crazy passing shot. And then, you know, you see kids and they're like, gosh, like never doing that again. You know, even though they played the point perfect and, you know, it was the right play, they came in on the weakness, and all of a sudden they just come up with some crazy shot, instead of saying, all right, well, if they can do that for the whole match, then too good, then they deserve this one. Instead of kind of just seeing the big picture a little bit. So just a little reflection on maybe how those last two games go, what you did well, what you could improve on, stuff like that. Just kind of stepping back a little bit, you know, with your Gatorade, with your water, whatever, and then just reflecting and then trying to use those things you did well and keep them going, and then fix some things that you thought maybe you could have done better in those last two games.
So Eric, with COVID and the lack of tournaments and the lack of play and everybody being so safe and scared and all that kind of jazz.
Yep.
If you were a 12, 13 year old right now, what would be your training and game plan? What would you be doing right now? Would you be searching out for any tournaments you could find in states that are allowing them? Would you say, you know what, I'm going to take this time to improve my game? What would you be doing right now if you were 12?
Well, probably about 12 to 14 was when I started working with a trainer. So if I was, you know, take me back 15, a little over 15 years ago, to me right there, and this would have happened, and that I probably would have just tried to, you know, continued getting in the gym, getting stronger, getting faster, working on anything that needs to be changed with, you know, not many tournaments going on right now. But I was always one of those players that needed a lot of matches to feel, you know, to be playing my, I know a lot of kids and players and stuff like that, that can take some time off from tournament wise and then kind of come back and pick up from where they left off before. And I just kind of wasn't one of those players. I always felt like I needed a lot of matches to be match tough. So I probably would have been trying to find as many tournaments as I could to play. But if that just wasn't you know, there on the table, just really try to get into the gym and even at 13, 14 and to work on my kind of my body, getting stronger, getting the endurance up and stuff like that. And just try to have a timeline, even if it gets pushed back a little bit, kind of in your mind of when you have a tournament coming up. Because I always struggled with, you know, for a tennis player, like a month off is like, you know, off season pretty much is a ton of time off. So still try to have a game plan of being ready to play a little bit, even when there's nothing really in sight. So, but like I said, I've never really gone through anything like this. Obviously none of us have. So it's kind of hard to say exactly what I would do, but I guess just focus on what you can do. And that's just work on your game, your endurance, getting stronger. Any technique that needs attention right now, just use that to your advantage a little bit, and just be ready whenever you can, whenever the next tournament is.
Yeah. And, you know, like I say, you know, we did go through this, and Eric worked with some of the juniors around here during the COVID time. And the hardest thing was finding courts that you wouldn't get kicked off of. And it seemed like every place we went, we were constantly getting, you know, run out of the neighborhood or whatever. So it was really tough to even find court time. So like I said, you know, and gyms are closed too. So it's like that. You can't go to a gym. You've got to sort of build your own gym, you know, with bands or endurance or something like that. You sort of have to do your own training and just sort of make it work. And it was, like I say, it was hard here in Louisville. And I think it was probably hard in most places as well, you know, just for those reasons. And everything. But, you know, when you say that you would focus maybe more on your strength and your conditioning and your fitness, what are some specific exercises that, say, a prepubescent, you know, someone that's, you know, 12 to 13, who's not necessarily gone through puberty yet, you know, what are some exercises that you would recommend that they do to get strong and to get, you know, more power and, you know, maybe, you know, more strength? What could they do, and what did you do, and what would you recommend to others?
And that's an important question, because it's got to be different than what an offensive lineman playing football, right? So because of how being limber is important, and stretching and all that kind of stuff. So they may not necessarily want to bulk up. So that's a great question, Scott. I'm interested to hear his answer.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the biggest things that I worked on, my trainer helped me a lot, especially at that age, was obviously we weren't lifting a lot of heavy weights, not trying to get hurt or anything like that. But it was, you know, something that we definitely worked on, trying to get a little bit stronger. But we did a lot of explosive movements, a lot of first step stuff. So we did a lot of bands where he'd, you know, wrap the band around my waist and, you know, we'd only maybe 10 yards or something like that, but just working on that first step and moving to the ball a little bit quicker, taking the correct step, using the right foot, going to the forehand or the backhand, stuff like that. So just making sure kind of the fundamentals were there as far as the movement goes and running to the ball.
So creating resistance, let's say a band around your waist, and it would hold you back, and then you would try and explode through that? Okay, yeah.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, a lot of places do that, which is a good one. One of the things, kind of going back to another thing that I've learned, coaching in the last couple of years is, I think what I did really well is I could create pace. I was a very powerful, aggressive player. And, I think it came really natural to me, one, from working out at a young age, you know, starting getting the gym at 12, 13, 14. But I feel like I really learned how to use my body to create power on, you know, especially my forehand. So I think that is something that juniors could do a lot of, how your body can actually help you make it easier on yourself, instead of kind of just using that arm or using very minimal body parts to help you, you know, create pace. So I think there's a lot of medicine balls. Another kind of popular thing that you see a lot is, you know, you just get against a brick wall or whatever, and you take a medicine ball and you kind of get the twist to work on the core a little bit. But I think that that exercise does kind of, when you use your legs, you use your core and you use your whole body, it makes the exercise a lot easier. And so you're kind of realizing where the power comes from a little bit with your legs, your core, stuff like that. So I think that's a good, good exercise for kids to understand where power comes from and how I can use that, you know, to hit a little bit stronger and actually make it a little bit easier on my arm and, you know, easier on my whole body if I prepare a little bit earlier and I use the correct.
Yeah. The great thing about the medicine ball is you can really replicate the strokes in tennis, you know, your forehand, your backhand, inside out, whatever. You know,
absolutely.
You can do the same stroke with the medicine ball, and then you go and hit the same stroke with your racket. And like you say, you know, then you've created that core strength in that thrust area in the hips and the legs.
Yep.
And, you know, it's very tennis specific. So I think that's a great one too. Yeah.
And I think that's a good exercise that, you know, I worked with a trainer when I was playing pro, and a different one than from when I was growing up. And he was big on, kind of one of the first things we went over is like, what is your daily kind of routine a little bit? Obviously it involves stretching, you know, some strength work as well. A lot of prehab stuff. But I think that would be a good exercise to throw in every day, even if it's like morning of a match or whatever. Obviously you probably wouldn't go with a heavier medicine ball when you're kind of using it more of like a warm up prehab type of thing. But I think that's just, cause it, you know, replicates, you know, a forehand and backhand so well. So I think that's just a huge exercise to warm up with. And, you know, when you're really trying to get in the gym and get after a little bit, I think that's a good one. But we just did a lot of going back to 12, 13, 14. You know, I was lifting a little bit, nothing crazy, but just trying to work on explosiveness and kind of worked on mentality a little bit too. I remember my trainer, he had my mom come in because, you know, when things got tough a little bit, you know, you could just see it on my face a little bit. So he would have me do all these exercises in the mirror while my mom's standing behind me kind of recording, because he just really wanted to see, made me go home and watch kind of what the facial expressions. And his big thing was that, and just kind of, and he always kind of made sure I knew what number we were on. So he wouldn't really say anything, you know, we'd be in the middle of a rep and he'd be like, what number are you on? So just his big thing was, you know, not giving your opponent anything with your facial expressions, and just always being in the moment a little bit. So just kind of, he was big on mentality a little bit. And I think 12, 13, 14, definitely a time that you want to work on kind of the tone you're sitting on the match and kind of just the presence you want to have during a match.
Yeah. And then how would that change as the kid gets to, you know, 15 to 18, would you start to go a little bit heavier, or would you do different exercises, or how would the fitness or the strength training change as you transition from, you know, the through puberty?
Yeah. I don't think, you know, you may incorporate some other exercises in there, but, I don't think it would get very, very different, at all. Obviously you're going to, you know, add a little bit more weight. You may do a few more reps. When I was getting 16, 17, 18, I was working out maybe one or two more days a week than I was, you know, at that 12, 13, I was doing 3 days a week. And then when I was getting to 16, 17, I was doing 4 to 5 days a week. Cause you know, I feel like the body could handle, you know, that extra days that need as much a recovery time, as I did, you know, when I was a little bit younger. So, you know, there's some things that might change, but I think it's just the duration of, you know, as long as you're, or how long you're working out for, and the weight that you're doing, and kind of the intensity you have into it. And I think that's true on the court and off the court. You know, I don't think the drills on the tennis court change very much, even from the top guys. You know, you see Djokovic doing the 2 cross 1 line, and he'll just do it, you know, for hours at an end. Obviously, you know, 13, you know, there's not too many 13, 14 year olds doing the same drill. You know, not many people any age doing the same drill for hours on end. And so I think it's just how long you're doing it, the intensity. Obviously, the expectations are a little bit higher when you're older. I don't think there's a whole lot that changes because between 12, 14. to when you're, you know, 16 beyond.
Let me ask you this, Eric. So if you were taking a group of kids to a tournament, what would you have their pre-match and post-match routines be like? Or maybe this is something that you could reflect on what you did as a junior, but, you know, as a coach, how would you have a kid, you know, get ready for a match? And then once the match is over, what would sort of those routines look like?
I would say, good question. But what I would say, depending on the match time, you know, as I went up in levels, kind of when you, what I feel like each, so the pros, futures, challengers, and then ATP, Grand Slam, whatever, as I get to play each level, very fortunate, but each level, kind of the warm up and stuff start a little bit earlier. Now, I think it's a little bit easier, ATP, Grand Slam, when your earliest match is 11, you know, 11:30 in the morning is the earliest you could play. Versus, you know, you play a Southern tournament and, you know, you got an 8 a.m. match. It's a little bit tougher to have that same kind of getting there a couple, 2-3 hours before the match is a little tough when you play at 8 a.m. But get there as early as you, you know, beforehand, as early as you can. Get that warm up in. Have a little rest time beforehand. Stretch or whatever. Cool down a little bit. Just kind of go over the game plan a little bit and then do a little quick, get the feet moving. Maybe it's like the medicine ball, you kind of incorporate, get the core a little bit, get the feet moving, get those quick twitch muscles going. And then as far as a kind of a cool down a little bit, always like kind of the players or me, I guess, kind of have 5-10 minutes, kind of just a little cool down to yourself a little bit. And then like a quick little jog, not very long at all. Get into a stretch, and I was big on foam rolling. I feel like that helped me a lot. So I foam rolled and stretched after. And if depending on what the schedule looked like, I know a lot of junior tournaments, it's not that rare to have two matches in a day or doubles after that or whatever that is. But when I was playing, you know, professionally, you played, one singles match, and then, you know, you might have one double. So it was easy to go work on something afterwards, especially while you're warmed up a little bit before you stretch and cool down. You know, if you didn't hit go hit 10, 15 minutes worth of serves and go hit, you know, get a fed ball, get some fed ball in or something, work on that before you cool down, something like that. So it just depends kind of what the scenario is. I know a lot of times you get like an hour and a half in between matches. So that kind of, you got to speed some stuff up because you got to go get some food and all that. But if you have the time, just kind of reflect on the match a little bit to yourself, and then just kind of cool down, foam roll and stretch a little bit.
Yeah. And did you take like a notebook with you, and would you make like match notes and maybe, you know, start to chart your opponent so that if you played them again, you know, what would work, what didn't work, and those kind of things, so that you'd have that for future reference? Or is that something that you did not do?
I did do that. I wish I would have started earlier. What I did was kind of one, make it just like a journal, like how I was feeling before the match, what I did, stuff like that, what was going on in the world, kind of. But I would also, you know, write down who I played, what worked for me, what didn't work, a few of his tendencies, stuff like that, so I could go back, you know, later date if I played him again, and kind of just see what worked for me that day and what didn't a little bit. But it wasn't a whole lot of, you know, he served this many times to, you know, wasn't too detailed, but yeah, just always tried to kind of, maybe even I would even write kind of the day before, like, hey, I play this guy. You know, this is what I remember a little bit, just writing it down. It seemed like it kind of helped me a little bit. And it was just kind of fun to look back now. I still have the journal and just kind of see what was what I was thinking playing that guy, and kind of, you know, how I felt on the court and all that. So I don't really, I think it evolved a little bit, kind of what I was writing and stuff, but still kind of fun to just see what I was thinking during that time. So I encourage that for players. Yeah.
Yeah. You remember who's a cheater and who's not.
That's right. That's right.
So Eric, as you know, you talked a lot about being match tough and how you needed to play a lot of matches, and, I think that resonates with watching my own child. You know, he gets not rusty, but the emotional part, he's not as emotionally strong if he's not playing a lot.
How did you
just play a lot of tournaments? I mean, I would imagine when you were 14, it was really hard for you to find anybody who could give you any type of competition in your area. Mm-hmm. So how did you find that competition? Did you just travel a bunch?
Well, actually, you know, 14 was actually kind of my breakout year. That was, started working out like the very beginning of when I turned 14. And that was really when I made the finals of the Southerns. And that was, I was like one of the last 17 seeds, in the tournament. And then I made it to the finals and then had a good summer, made it to, you know, qualified through that, the national hard courts and clay courts and stuff like that. So it was about 14 when I started, you know, really making some headway there. So what I did starting about that age is there was a lot of adults that I started playing with. And I think that was huge for my game, just to see different types of, you know, a lot of the guys I played with were a little older school. So they're serving a volley and, you know, hit a flatter ball, stuff like that. So I think that really helped me. And I started playing, you know, at the time there was a lot of money tournaments and stuff around, which was, you know, just filled with a lot of adults. So I think that helped me a lot, just seeing different style of play and, you know, made me work on different stuff and different mentality, you know, cause a lot of guys I was with, they, you know, helped me out, give me suggestions, stuff like that. So I think that was something. And I think that's something that juniors can do a little bit more of, kind of try to get some adults, play people that just kind of give you different challenges and different ways to play a little bit. And I think, you know, I got to hit with a lot of college kids in town. And so, I just got to see a lot of, instead of just hitting with a lot of the peers, I play with a lot of older people. And now, you know, a lot of the college kids had to, you know, pay like, hey, will you give you $25? Will you, you know, pay, play a set or two with me or whatever a couple times a week. And I think that was huge for me. I looked up to a lot of those guys. So I think that was huge for me, getting to do stuff like that.
Yeah. I think that's really good advice. And I think, you know, I think Robert, you have some experience with that, and I think, it helps a lot. And I think it also helps from a mentality standpoint, because, you know, if you're playing an adult, you can't act like a baby on the court. You know?
Absolutely.
You can't do Absolutely. The same things that you might do in a junior match. You know, so I think it would help with the mentality and maturity.
You're not going to go sit on the, you know, the side and talk about, you know, what you're going to do this weekend with, you know, a 40-year-old, you know. So I think that's right.
Well, and I think the challenge too is, as a parent, right, I mean, if you live in an area similar to where we live, mm-hmm. and there's going to be a lot of people in our country who have a player that don't live in, you know, Southern Cal, where there's a ton of players.
Exactly. Yes.
And so the challenge is, do you want to be gone every weekend with tournaments? And mm-hmm. and so I love your solution is, we'll just find some high level adults and compete against them. The hard thing is what Scott just said. So every once in a while, when they aren't at their peak behavior, mm-hmm. sometimes those adults watch them act like an idiot and they don't want to play them anymore. Right.
Yeah.
And the hard thing is, when you watch high level players, sometimes they behave and sometimes they don't, even at the top level, you know,
for sure. There's no doubt about it. Absolutely.
So, you know, was there ever a moment when you were younger that you were playing an adult and then you kind of acted like an idiot and regretted it?
I was actually pretty good, I feel like. Now, when I was playing when I was like 9 or 10 years old, I was playing in just like a local tournament at the club that I LIRC, where I grew up playing. And I, you know, loved to watch guys on TV, and I thought it was cool to throw your racket and, you know, get mad and stuff like that. And I remember my mom, she asked the tournament directors, super nice lady, worked at the club, you know, who was running the tournament, and said, hey, would you mind saying something to Eric, you know, not throw your racket? And she was like, couldn't have been nicer about it. And I like started crying, and then that was the end of that. yeah. So that was kind of the, after that, I was pretty much done. Never really, you know, that was something that I thought I did really well after that, was just in going back to my train a little bit, just kind of taking care of my, keeping my emotions to myself and not giving my opponent anything. Cause, and then I kind of really started paying attention to that and realizing how much like a boost of energy it gives you when you see your opponent either tired or throwing the racket, or, you know, a lot of times you see these kids and they'll just be like, I can't hit a back, you know, I can't hit a backhand forehand today. And they'll just tell you, you know, what they're really thinking. So, that was something I thought I did really well. And, I think it goes back to, you know, playing with a lot of adults, and, you know, I knew that, you know, it's out of your comfort zone a little bit, cause it isn't your peers and stuff like that. So I never really wanted to kind of, you know, present myself like that to especially someone that I'm not too comfortable being around. So I think, and I'm sure a lot of kids would do the same if they were, you know, I think that would be another reason why I would encourage playing with adults, because I feel like most kids wouldn't, you know, they would behave a little bit better than they would around their peers who might think it's cool to, you know, throw the racket, or you feel like it's acceptable, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, to find adults to hit with, it's not always the easiest thing, or it can be a challenge, but, you know, maybe with the UTRs, you know, a lot of adults sign up for those. And so there you're sort of forced to play with adults. And so that's one way, if you don't really know how to get matches with adults, that might be a way to do it. And how did you get to hit with college players? One of the things that, you know, we've been fortunate to hit with a few, but, you know, it's always kind of an awkward thing how to navigate, you know, but, you know, with you being a former college player, you know, what's the sort of the protocol for, you know, asking a college player to train with you? What's the right way to go about it?
The whole way I guess I got set up with that is my coach at the time, Rob Spencer. He was, well, I guess not, a guy who played at University of Georgia named Colin Purcell, who he worked with. And obviously he was at Georgia then. But he was real tight with Colin or whatever, and, you know, kept in touch with him and while he was at Georgia, and he would come back here in the summers and stuff like that. So he was kind of the one who suggested it and really set it up a little bit, and then had a lot of success with that and really enjoyed it. And there's someone I looked up to and thought it was so cool to hit with them. And so after that, you know, just kind of like, well, who else can we get a little bit? And that's when I really started hitting with adults and stuff like that, and kids quite not my age. And I thought that was, you know, it was someone I looked up to when he was at Georgia. I mean, they made the finals in NCAA. They're undefeated. They actually lost in the finals, but he was, you know, teammates with Isner, and Colin played court five, and he had an unreal record and stuff like that. So, so that it was my coach that really set it up and suggested it. And it just went really well. And, you know, obviously he never really let me win, and he'd try to bring me to the net and hit me, but I feel like it just kind of was a good thing a little bit, just toughened me up a little bit. And, you know, just someone for me to look up to. And, you know, I think in Louisville, there's, and just all over a little bit, it's, you know, you don't really get that opportunity and see that a whole lot of, you know, someone almost taking, you know, a younger kid under their wing a little bit. Even though, like, I was still paying him, it's not like he was just like had the kindness out of his heart, you know, especially a college kid. It's nice to, I guess, give him a few bucks, but it's still really clear, cool.
You know, is there any sort of NCAA violation with doing something like that? Is the money just
I don't
material
think so.
Or? I just want to make sure that, you know, that, you know, everything's up and up and. And everything. Yes. 'Cause I think it is something that, you know, is very beneficial to both the college player and the junior player to have those relationships and to have those opportunities. And, you know, so like I said, I think that, you know, that's something that players should search out a lot more.
Yes.
I agree. I agree.
Yep. And I think the three things that really, you know, made me aspire to, you know, play pro tennis, play college tennis was one, getting to hit with Colin Purcell, and two, growing up playing, getting to watch every summer 18s clay courts nationals was held at, you know, local tennis club. Then they also had every other year, they had the top college indoor nationals was also at LTC. So, and then those couple tournaments, and then getting to, my mom volunteered at the Cincinnati Masters, and she would just volunteer because she grew up playing tennis as well and played tennis. Mm-hmm. And so I just get to tag along. So getting to see just that high level tennis every summer, and you know, every other winter, getting to see those guys was, and then getting to be around Colin just was so cool. And I think that's where, you know, at least in Louisville, we don't have the clay courts anymore. We don't have the indoor nationals. You know, there's Cincinnati still 2 hours away, but just getting to see, you know, that high level tennis at, you know, up and close at a young age was really something that inspired me. And I think that's something that hurts, you know, Louisville tennis a little bit, just not getting to see all that high level tennis at a young, you know, all those young kids getting to watch that and aspire to be, you know, those guys.
Yeah, I think, and I think Louisville used to have a challenger event as well in the fall.
Yes, it did.
Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah.
I did. I got to play that. Yeah, I think it was about 08, 09, kind of when the recession hit a little bit. Just lost the sponsor and stuff like that. But, you know, Isner played that. I got to play it. I got to play it 1 year, which was awesome. All those tournaments, I think, is just something that was so important for, you know, junior development in the area. Getting to watch those guys and, you know, dream to be them one day for sure.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I think what you're alluding to is, you know, being around high level tennis doesn't seem so far away. It doesn't seem like it's just a dream.
Exactly.
Oh, I can do that. You know? And so it's like, you know, if you're, like I say, that's maybe one of the tough things for us in Louisville is we don't have, you know, a ton of players that go on to play college tennis or pro tennis or anything like that. And so it's hard for maybe some of these local kids to think that they can do it. And so you know, sometimes, you know, if you go to an academy, you know, you're on a court next to, you know, a really high ranked player, the closer you are to it, the more it feels like it's real.
So sometimes
you've got to sort of put yourself in those positions where you're next to those great players. And so, you know, and then they can, you know, talk to you or you can, you know, whatever. It just seems like it's a little bit more real of a dream to do what you want to do when you're around those other players that are already doing that.
Exactly. And I think that's what you did a great job taking Luke to all those challengers in the area and stuff like that. And you can just kind of, you know, see that they're just, you know, real guys and they're just like you would, you know, just like Luke or just like, you know, me or whatever. That, you know, it is something you can really do if, you know, they're not superheroes and, you know, robots or whatever. They're just people that were driven and motivated and worked hard and, you know, and that's it. So, I mean, everyone can do it. It's just, you know, and it's so good to, you know, for young kids to see that, that they're, you know, really, if you kind of hang around, especially like a challenger stuff where they're just kind of walking around, you can just see, you know, they're just normal guys and make jokes and do everything else. So I think, like you said, it's just good for kids to see that.
Yeah, and like I said, Robert, you know, you've done the same thing there in Memphis, going to the Futures with Everett and seeing that and getting to know some of the players. And, you know, wherever you are, I think that, you know, there's something, you know, in the United States or around the world, there's usually at least a Futures or a Challenger that you can go to. So
exactly.
You know, if you can, you know, do it because – you know, like you say, you can see these guys, you know, their habits, their routines, and you're right there on the court with them and you can sort of see what their balls, how they hit the ball and all that stuff. So it's really educational.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you can learn a lot.
It's equally as valuable as practice. I mean, when they see those guys out there play a match completely exhausted and then foam roll and stretch afterwards, they're learning those discipline, you know, those habits and realizing that if I want to do that, though, these are the things that come along with it, right?
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah, I agree.
So, Scott, I want to hear about some of these stories you've been talking about.
Story time.
Scott? Did we lose him?
Uh-oh.
Sorry, I hit mute for a second.
Oh, that's all right.
Can you hear me now?
So, Scott, I want to hear some of these stories you've been talking about.
Yeah. Okay. So, We'll talk a little bit about Eric's pro career. You know, and like I say, from those experiences, you know, he'll drop some wisdom on us, you know, during a practice. And so I think it's good to share. But, you know, just to give the audience, you know, some perspective, you know, Eric, you have wins over Denis Shapovalov, Felix, Azir Aliassime, Tommy Paul, Francis Tiafoe, Riley Opelka, Taylor Fritz, Mackenzie McDonald, and kids like that. So sort of these next gen guys that, you know, we see coming up through the ranks. But what was some of the things that maybe stood out to you as to why these guys were special players? I mean, obviously Opelka's 7 feet tall, so maybe that's not something that we can work on. But the other guys, you know, they're not necessarily superhuman. But mm-hmm. what were some things that stood out to you and why these guys are, you know, making the rise that they are now?
I think one of the biggest things about that whole group there, for one, let me make a little statement there. All those guys you mentioned, I named, I think they were about like 17, 16, 17 when I beat them. So had a few years on them. But nonetheless, they were awesome all players at that age.
Yeah.
But I think what helped all those guys is, one, they're all great athletes, good competitors. They know how to play the game. They have good court awareness. They're unbelievable ball strikers. But they're all kind of aging that same not Shapovalov, Denis, he's from, you know, Canada, but all those Americans, they all grew up training together. Every time I kind of go down to Boca, USCA kind of preseason a little bit, they'd all be there. They all train there. They're all buddies. So they're all pushing each other. And they're all kind of genuine buddies. They weren't, you know, worried like if they, you know, obviously they wanted to beat each other, but, you know, they didn't ruin relationships by, you know, playing each other. So I think they all kind of were all friends, all pushed each other, all the same age, growing up together a little bit. And I think that's huge. I think,
In our last podcast we had with Diego Moyano, who was the USTA player development coach.
Coached
what's
a lot
amazing
of those guys.
He coached Tommy Paul. He coached Francis. He coached Riley and he coached Taylor, you know, sort of the four top Americans. And he wasn't there. Maybe he wasn't their primary coach, but he worked with them quite a bit.
Oh, he for sure worked with them. Yes.
Yeah. And so it's like, it's amazing that he had, you know, the four Americans of all the Americans, of all the peak players in America, the four that have sort of risen to the top, he was involved in their development. So I think that's really testament to him, and you know what, and I'll say, if you listen to the podcast, you can just see how passionate he was and how wise he is, and it's not surprising that he has such good results.
Yes, yeah, all those guys. I mean, they work so hard, and they're around great coaches like Diego and Jay Berger and Andy Brandy and a lot of those guys. I was down there, and then when I was heading back home, you know, preseason, they were, half of them were going to Texas to train and stay with Roddick for a couple of days, and then the other half were going to Orlando and training with Jim Courier. So but that's just credit to USDA kind of using all their resources and, you know, giving them to their top guys to you know, just be around that experience and getting to train and, you know, see what those guys, you know, do. And so but yeah, I think that was just so important for them to all be kind of, it was cool to see them all be buddies. Cause I think that's just so rare. Cause you know, a lot of them, you have, you know, friends, but then like, you know, you hate that person when you lose to them and like that. So it was all, you know, so cool to see them all really kind of push each other, and they were all genuine buddies. You know, so I think they enjoyed, you know, getting to train and stay in Orlando, which is pretty tough for, you know, a young kid to kind of leave wherever they're from and move down there. But they, you know, they were all good friends, and so they always were having a good time, working hard. And they're all those guys are really, really good people. They're always cool, always, you know, they're all good people. So I'm glad they're having success, and doesn't surprise me at all that they're, you know, all top 100, top 50 in the world right now.
Awesome. So you play, this is kind of interesting, you know, I'm not sure what year it was, maybe 2017, you played Denis Shapovalov in back-to-back tournaments.
Yes.
I think in Memphis, you lost to him 7-5, 6-4. Then
that's
in
right.
Little Rock, a week later, you beat him 6-2, 6-1.
Yeah.
What was the turnaround there? How did you go from losing 5-4 to winning 2-1?
It's, so played Dennis. Yeah, lost 5-4. That I knew who he was. Played a lot of tournaments in Canada before that, and you know they would give him wild card, him and Felix some wild cards, and you know, so I kind of saw him play before. Never really played him, and then what he did so well, and he still does well, is he covered the corners really well. Like his best shots were on the run, forehand or backhand.
Right.
And so like I just didn't kind of adapt to that and learn in the first match. Like, I mean, he just killed me out of the corners a little bit. And so I thought that was kind of one of the smartest matches I'd played in my career. Is, you know, one, I had a week to just think about that match and get ready for, obviously I didn't know I was going to play in the next week until, you know, a day or two before. But I thought I really made some good adjustments in that second match, and I played well that tournament, played well against him in the first round. You know, did help that I had.
What were the adjustments that you made?
Well, you know, I just said, I'm going to hit up the middle. I'm not going to let him on the run, you know, out of the corners, you know, me come in and then he passed me again, or on the baseline and he hits a running, you know, screamer against me again.
Yeah.
So I literally just didn't allow him to use his his footwork and his speed to beat me. So I just played everything up the middle until I just got the absolute ball that I wanted to attack, and then kind of take it from there.
And that's a really, you know, that's maybe just one of the things that, you know, we don't think of as a strategy, but hitting deep down the middle, takes away your opponent's angles, like you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to give you probably something short in the middle of the court. And then then that's when you can go to where you want to go.
Exactly.
So I think, you know, as a junior, I think that's a really smart strategy. You know, I think, you know, my son plays his best matches when he's not missing wide. And so if you're just hitting good balls down the middle, you really can't get hurt. And then you just wait. You just have to be patient and wait for the right ball.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, it was night and day how good he was out of the corners. I mean, even on that one-handed backhand at a young age, I mean, he could just fire him. Yeah. So, like I said, it was one of the, I played great that match, and I thought I executed kind of my game plan about as good as it could possibly be. To my credit, you know, I think I lost to him second or third round. So I had about, you know, 5, 6, 7 days off where he was coming, you know, he had like 2 days off from winning the week before. So that helped me. I thought I played the really smart, and I think earlier that year or the year before I played him and Felix in doubles at a future in Canada. And I remember we won like 11-9 in the third set breaker. And I was like, man, and I told my partner, I knew the guy, he played at Tennessee. Never really played with him before. And we just kind of grouped up and played doubles. And we kind of walked up the course like, man, like, I didn't think we played that bad. But, you know, on paper, you know, you're pro and you play, you know, 2 16-year-olds from Canada in Canada, thinking, gosh, I'd like to think that we could win that match a little bit, you know, more routine than we could. But, you know, like some of the shots they hit were just spectacular.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, like you say, you know, you're out of college at this point. You had a very successful college career. You know, you have, for those who don't know, you held the record for, or have the record for most wins ever by an NCAA player. So obviously one of the best players to ever play college tennis. And then there's your 16-year-old that you're struggling against.
That's right.
So it's just it's amazing that level. Is there anything that Dennis did, you know, sort of in practice, you know, when you saw him, you know, outside the matches that he was doing, that was something that, you know, you thought was really showed his potential?
I mean, a lot of times you just always see him on the practice court. You know, I practice with him a lot. We are kind of buddies a little bit. So we practiced a lot, and just his commitment. I mean, he was hitting before me. He was hitting, you know, after he just had constant, like, you know, practices lined up. I think I talked about this last time, you know, a tournament and a challenger out in California. He lost in quali's first round, had kind of a bad loss for him. And the next day him and another guy who lost first round, they were just literally hitting cross courts for hours at a time. And they'd put a shoe in the cross court, and they just keep going until someone hit the shoe. Whoever, you know, hit the shoe, the other person had to do like a suicide. They do that for like the first 30 minutes. And then like the punishment would be like, you know, 30 pushups, whatever it was. And then they would just do that for, you know, 2-3 hours, just hitting just simple as cross course like
just
that.
Just the most mundane drill you could think of. And they're just, they're just doing it.
Just hammering into the ground.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I love that.
Yep.
That's great.
Yep. And then, but yeah, I mean, I knew that he was going to be, he had such a live arm. I mean, his serve was so heavy and stuff like that. And just how, you know, like I said, going, how good he was out of the corners and made, you know, tough shots look so easy. And, you know, and doing all this at, you know, 16, 17 years old. So, yeah, once again, not a surprise that he's kind of where he is right now. So just his dedication to the game and how much he loved it and loved hard work. And
these are some players that I think all the listeners will know, but who's somebody you played either in, you know, in college or in the juniors who you thought, man, that guy right there, he's going to win the US Open. And then most people don't even know who he is.
Good question. Oh man. I know they're out there. I'm going to have to think about that. Let me come back to you on that. Cause I know exactly what you're.
We'll come back to it. While you're thinking about it, you know, one of the things I noticed in your record was that, and professionally, you were 0-4 against Tennis Sandgren. How was your, and he's in the Southern section, so you guys probably played a lot as juniors. How did you guys play in juniors?
I remember playing tennis, all the way back to like a blue gray tournament in Mobile, Alabama. We were real young. We played so much that I beat him. He beat me. I beat him in college. We played once in college. I beat him in college. It would be hard to even say how many times we played each other. Cause just going back from, you know, like I'm sure there's kids that, you know, Luke and you guys have played so much as being from, you know, state. And I was right in between tennis and his older brother, Davey, who also played at Tennessee, played him several times, played him in the finals of the Southern tournament at Thanksgiving in Louisville, played him in the finals once or twice, played him at Tennessee, like I said, and then played tennis as well in college. I wasn't always defeated by Sandgren, but yeah, he definitely got me in the pros for sure.
Any memorable matches with him? Was he always sort of the same character he was that he is today? Or
he was always the same character. Great guy. But he was one of those guys that, I mean, the way he played and always gave me a lot of trouble. I mean, he could just kind of go on lockdown where you could just see it in the way he plays. Like, okay, I'm just not going to miss. And he could do that. He could literally just sit back and put 50 balls in play. And as you know, he got to the pros, he got taller, he got stronger, and his serve got so much better. He got weapons, and he still had that kind of where he could just go and just not make an error there. And especially in, you know, he did that to his advantage in big moments there where, you know, he'd be like, all right, if you're going to beat me, you got to come with some great shots. And if he got a racket on it, you know, it was going to go over the net. And I think that's what he does so well. He can just literally just kind of go in that mindset where I'm just not going to miss, and he won't make an error. So, and that was not the recipe I like to see on the other side of the net, but not many do.
So sort of similar to Robert's question, but was there any players that you owned in the juniors that you couldn't beat in the pros and vice versa? Were there any guys that you just couldn't beat in the juniors, but then once you got to college, you figured him out?
His older brother was one of them. He owned me in everything that we played, like in all the Southern tournaments, he owned me. And then I got him in a big match my freshman year where he was a junior senior at Tennessee. I beat him 7-6 in the third. And that was a big moment for, you know, my college career. Just those, that gave us the win over Tennessee. That was big. Someone I owned in the juniors was Steve Johnson, and he owned me in college. And so I was, well, didn't really own him. I was 2-0 against them in the juniors.
That's 100%. So we'll consider that
100%. That's right.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. So when you say in the juniors you beat him 2-0, what changed in his game in the pros that made him harder to play or harder to beat?
I think one of the biggest things is his slice got better and he got in a lot better shape. Always heard that he was super talented, but then he really just kind of started taking the game more serious when he got to college and, you know, got in better shape. And his serve got better. He always had a great kick serve, but his first serve got so much better. He still played the same way, you know, when I played him in juniors, you know, sliced the backhand a lot, and then had like a great heavy forehand. But his first serve was unreal when it got to college and, you know, and beyond. I remember when I played him in the finals of NCAAs. I mean, I remember big points, you know, I had several break points in some games, and I just remember thinking, I haven't got my racket on any of these. So I'm just kind of like going back percentages, you know, he's gone, you know, out wide a lot and guess right. And still not, you know, barely just touch it. So, I mean, he was just pinpoint accurate on that first serve. He disguised it really well. It's hard to tell where he was going with it. He kind of has somewhat of a kind of a quick toss a little bit. So it's hard to kind of get a read on it. And so and that was something I really struggled with, that serve. And, you know, the whole match, you're always trying to figure out the serve, and then you kind of forget about your own serve. So worried about just trying to get a, you know, a racket on his. And so, but yeah, his serve, no doubt, was got a lot better, and he just got a lot better shape. And he's one of those guys that you could just, you could put him in anything, and he's just a good competitor. I remember training with him a couple weeks after I played him in the finals NCAAs. I went out to California and trained at USTA, and we played like a pickup after weights one day. We played a pickup basketball game, and he hit like a three to win the game. He's just kind of like a gamer. It's the best way to put it. Whatever the competition is, he just kind of rises to the occasion a little bit and kind of thrives in those situations a little bit. So
yeah, just a competitor, right? Just
exactly. A competitor. Yeah. He's just mastered competing. I think just, he knows to play the game. He loves those moments where, you know, a lot of people kind of get a little nervous. I mean, he rises to the occasion. So, and I think he did that, you know, definitely when I'm going back to the finals in NCAAs, it's a court awareness. You know, a couple people asked me like, man, did you not know he was hurt in the finals? And I was like, no, I didn't. I didn't. I know he kind of had a long road, tough road to get there. For one, I mean, well, he did it all 4 years. His team won, USC won the title all 4 years when I was in college. And so he, and so that, you know, the
so
last
that,
2 years.
That means they did the team event before the individual event. So he's playing matches in the team event.
Exactly.
And then you go straight to the singles event. And lot of those, it seems like a lot of times the top players from the teams that win, they lose early because they're just so exhausted.
Yes.
So it's really impressive that he was.
So, I mean, I remember a lot of times they would have like the guys would play at night after the women's in the finals. And so, and then the very next morning, you know, obviously you got a later start, but the very next day you got to start singles and doubles. So, I mean, it was very impressive what he did. And, you know, a long couple of weeks, you know, junior and senior year of winning the team and then going right into winning the singles. So, he's just a gamer is the best way to put it. He just knows how to compete. Well, that's for sure.
Well, let's jump back to Robert's question. So who is that guy that you're like, this guy's definitely got the game. He's going to be a big time pro and never really made it.
I would say, I'm trying to think, Brasso. I think Garrett Brasso, his brother, played at Georgia, and it was his older brother who I played in the juniors a little bit. And it was, he kind of lost interest a little bit, I think, as he got 18s and in college, stuff like that. But he had textbook technique, great player, easy power. You know, he just had the whole total package. So he's one of them that kind of comes to mind, that I'm not sure exactly where he went to college. But I thought he was one of those at a young age that, that was going to make it. Let me think here.
And he just, when you talked to him, he just lost interest.
He was a little bit older than me, so I didn't know him too well, but I played him a couple of times and I thought he, you know, like, he just had the whole, you know, he did everything really well at a young age. You know, he could come to the net and finish. He had very good technique. So I think he was one of them, but still kind of struggling to find a better one.
Did you know some guys like that or girls that just uber talent and just really didn't enjoy playing tennis?
Yes. Yeah. I think what's so tough about, you know, being a professional is not like, obviously you got to be like, have a good work ethic and obviously you got to have some talent, but there's so many other factors that go into, you know, like you got to love to travel. That was something that, you know, I kind of struggled with a little bit, being on the road, like, for, you know, 35 to 40 weeks out of the year. You know, just something that I think why I did so well in college is that I'm a very kind of structured guy. I love routines. And, you know, as the tennis season in college gets going, you know, it was pretty much a routine. You know, you could get going and it was just like the same thing every week. You'd play on, you know, Friday, Saturday. You may have a match on Wednesday, but for the most part, it was like Friday, Sunday. And then, you know, you get back to, you get to practice, you get back to school, you practice 3-4 days, and then you get ready for your your Friday, Sunday. And it was just a routine. And so that was something that I loved. You know, just, you get a good thing going and you just keep it going throughout the season. And then the pros are anything but a routine, really. You know, you don't know when I played several tournaments where, heck, I remember, 1 year, it was the last tournament, it was Champion Challenger. I had a bad loss in qualies. I get home, you know, thinking, all right, that's it for the year. It's, you know, middle of November, beginning of November, really. And then I get a phone call, and, you know, 8:30 at night saying, hey, you know, we got this money tournament in, you know, NC State. Love for you to come. It starts Friday. You know, it's Wednesday. So you'd probably have to, you know, leave tomorrow. It's like, well, you know, okay, sure. Go play it. Got nothing else to do for, you know, a month and a half. Go play it. And I, you know, I have one of the best tournaments, you know, one of the best wins in my, beat Donald Young 2-2 when he was top 100 in the world. And then Somdev Devarman, who was like 110, got a great paycheck or whatever. So it was anything but like, you know, a routine. You never knew when your next tournament was going to be. You never knew when you're going to be out a while. You never knew when you could get a practice court. So I think there's so many factors. You got to be flexible in order to be successful out there. And, you know, I had some of them, but, you know, like the travel and stuff was with me, and the routine, you know, just couldn't get in a routine out there and, you know, structured. So there's so many factors that, you know, guys can have all, you know, a bunch of those characteristics, but if they, you know, they don't have all of them, it's tough out there. So that's why it's tough to make it.
Good. Hey, Eric. Yep. Thanks so much for being on. We're running up against our time here, but we appreciate you coming on, and, you know, we love having this conversation. You know, the first conversation was great. I think this one was really good too. So hope to do it again, but I know we'll see you around Louisville here, and that's it. Robert, you have anything else to say?
Yeah, Eric, it was great, man. Enjoyed talking to you, and every time we talk, I learn a little bit. So thanks so much for being on.
Guys, thanks for having me. I always enjoy it, and you guys have awesome questions. So really enjoying my time here, kind of reminiscing a little bit. So thanks for having me again.
That's right. Okay.
Sounds good, Eric. All right. All right, we'll see you, man.